This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, editor-in-chief for Destroy the Cyborg, and with me this week is Paul Jaisley, staff editor and writer for comic books at Destroy the Cyborg. Paul, how's your week been?
It's been good, Mike. I've read a few comics, obviously, that I really enjoyed. I'm working through a big stack of old Judge Dredd comics I rescued from the dollar bin recently. So
nice.
It's been a lot of fun. They've been collecting dust, unfortunately, recently, but I've just sat down and been plowing through those. I'm currently in the middle of the first volume of Copra by Michelle Feef. Have you read this or heard of this, Mike?
Oh, man, I've heard the name. I guess I've heard people talk about it, but I guess other than that, I haven't heard anything.
Yeah. I mean, it's got a lot of buzz when it first came out, but because it was self-published, it was really hard to get your hands on. The Bergen Street Comic Book Shop in Brooklyn, New York, they published like a collection of the first six issues earlier this year, and it's fantastic. It's well worth getting your hands on. It's basically Michelle Feef doing an homage to the classic 80s Suicide Squad comics, but the artwork is like very psychedelic. It's very much an obviously a sort of creator-owned, more, I hate to use art comic or prestige comic than typical superhero comics, but it's action-packed, okay. And it's lovely. It's a great book.
Cool. That's cool, man. Yeah, so how did you find out about that one?
I popped up on Comics Alliance at some site, you know, said, hey, this is finally being collected, so I was able to order it from my local comic book shop, of course, and they got it for me. And, I definitely think it's worth your attention.
Cool. Maybe I will go, since I'm in New York now, maybe I will go down to the shop and actually check it out or something.
Check it out. And then one more I have to mention. I picked this up on a whim a few weeks ago and finally read it. Babies in Black by Arn Belstorff. It's a book about Astrid Kircher, who is a photographer who was friends with the Beatles when they were living and working in Hamburg, Germany in the early 60s.
Okay.
So the book is about, it's about the Beatles, sort of, but it's more about Astrid and Stuart Sutcliffe, who was the bass player in the band at the time. And they have a very intense, but sadly short-lived love affair. And this book is sort of takes a look at that. But it's really interesting if you're a Beatles fan to kind of get this interpretation and take on this history of the band when they were just getting started before they became, you know, the Beatles. It's a lovely book, beautifully illustrated. If you're a Beatles fan like me and you like comics, it's definitely worth checking out.
Cool. So this is different than the fifth Beatle book that came out from Boom Studios a little while ago?
Yeah. That was focused on their manager. But this book is, it's weird. The illustration style is very simple. And almost like childlike, but that's not a put down, because it really captures that feeling and excitement of like being in love as a teenager really well with that art style. I guess nice. It was originally published in Germany a few years ago, and they finally translated it. I think it's first second press put it out. So
yeah. Of course it is. Those guys, like, that's all they do is publish fantastic books.
Yeah. Everything I've picked up from them, I've loved. So.
Yeah, no, same here. I've actually been reading some stuff too. I mean, outside of my regular books and regular pulls, I picked up the Bucky Barnes Winter Soldier series. Like, I grabbed all of that on Comixology, and just because I've been like in an Alice Cott like obsession for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Especially I listened to this another podcast from these guys in Oregon, I believe, and they did an interview with him about his new series that's coming out in July called Wolf. But they also talked to him just about his time in comics in general and all the crazy shit that he's been doing.
Yeah.
And he mentioned how all of his books that he's been writing have somehow been related to like some sort of drug that he's done or some sort of drug use. And he was talking about how Zero is all about a mushroom trip, Bucky Barnes was all about like a bad Molly trip, and I was like, what the fuck? I have not read this book, so I grabbed it all because it's only like 9 issues out, so I read it all, and it is the craziest fucking book I've ever read. Like, that's in a superhero vein. Like, I am quite honestly, I am like just dumbfounded that Marvel let him get away with the shit he's doing in that book.
Sure.
Because it's so overt. Like, I guess once you hear that, yes, it's like about a bad Molly trip, it makes more sense. But like, even still, there is heavy, obvious drug use in that book. Like, and it's in your face. Like, Bucky Barnes is taking pink pills and is going on these trips out into far magical lanes with this unbelievable art by Marco Rudy. Okay. So if you take a step back and you look at the series, Marco Rudy, as an artist, is probably one of the most talented artists in comic books right now, hands down. I cannot find a person that parallels his range, his just absolute ability. And to think he's on a monthly book absolutely blows my mind. And I've seen little pieces of his art here and there from Marvel, and I haven't seen him anywhere else. But he did Matt Kent's Marvel... Him and Matt Kent did a series, Marvel Knights Spider-Man, that was all about Spider-Man kind of being just thrown through the gauntlet with all of his supervillains. It's a very fantastic read. I highly suggest that to anyone. Sure. Just if you know even the vaguest bit about Spider-Man, this book goes through and delivers all the information you need to know about all of Spider-Man's supervillains. And Marco Rudy on art, he varies from like watercolors to straight pencil art to line art to like infographics to like, I don't know. He's incredible. Like I said, he's probably one of the most talented artists right now in comic books. And to see him on Bucky Barnes with this whole drug-induced trip, essentially, just adds to like the insanity of the series. So I'm gonna pick that up. Oh my god! Like even if you could just read one issue, like it's such a ripoff to buy them all on Comixology. I'm sorry, you should wait for a sale to buy it because it's like $18.99 for the first six issues, which is unreasonable.
Yeah.
Either way, the series is great. And on an unrelated note, I finally went and found a copy of Andre the Giant. Because I know you've talked about it a bunch, and I recently read something that sparked my mind and said, hey, you know, I should actually buy that comic. So I went out and bought it at Forbidden Planet here, just because they were the only shop that I went to that had it, because Midtown Comics doesn't carry books from independent publishers, apparently, unless you special order them. So,
all right.
Anyways, you want to talk about our comic picks for the week?
Well, did you like Andre the Giant?
I haven't read it yet. I bought it yesterday. Right. I haven't, but I was like, it's on my list. I'm probably going to read it this week, so maybe I'll be able to talk about it next week.
Okay. Yeah, Box Brown just has a new book that just came out, I think last week, that I'm very excited to pick up. So, yeah.
Cool. Which one is that?
It's called An Entity Observes All Things. I don't know anything about it, but again, Box Brown is one of those guys I think is doing really interesting stuff, and I'll basically buy anything he does, sight unseen. So
cool. Cool. Well, you know, let's get to our comic picks. We can actually talk about this week's comic books.
Okay, sure.
And next week, we'll talk about all this cool shit that we found from this week, right?
Yeah.
So your pick this week, Paul, is Transformers versus G.I. Joe number 7, a series you've been championing for many, many weeks. What's happening with this book?
Oh, man. In case you haven't heard, I love this book unconditionally and fully. It's my favorite comic book. Every time it comes out, it's going to be my pick. Tom Scioli and John Barber are doing an amazing job of taking these franchises with storied histories that I know nothing about and making them very exciting to me as a new sort of reader. I don't know anything about Transformers or G.I. Joes, despite having grown up in the 80s. They were never my cup of tea. But, man, this book is fantastic. And the last issue 6, ended with one of the weirdest cliffhangers I've ever seen, and I have no idea how they're going to get out of it. Should I spoil it? Do you mind?
No, don't spoil it. I want to read it. I have it. I want to read it.
Okay. No, I mean, issue 6 ends in this way that completely changes what the book is about. Like, I have no idea what they're going to do. And it's one of those, it's a cliffhanger that, this might be giving too much away, but it's when I normally see this type of cliffhanger, I don't like it. But because this book has been so crazy and over the top, it's kind of like the best way for them to do it. Like, here's something I completely never expected to see. So I can't wait to see issue 7, how they either explain the way out of it or completely take another left turn and go somewhere completely unexpected. So this book, if you're not reading it, get your hands on a copy. I've given other people my guarantee. If you buy it and don't like it, I will reimburse you for it. So.
Oh man, that is super cool, dude. Yeah.
Because you've read the first trade of Transformers.
Oh, for G.I. Joe, right? I've read part of the first issue. Every time I go to sit down with the series, I get really intimidated by it. Like, because I have the trade, and I'm like, oh man, I need to read it. But I know that this is like a dedicated amount of time. Luckily, I've been in like this weird shitloads of free time like space, so I've been reading comics like crazy. So, I've almost caught up with all of Bloodshot and Harbinger Wars, Sure. Because Nick and I had like a whole argument about how he couldn't believe that I wasn't caught up. So I was like, well, fuck you, man. I'm going to prove you wrong. So maybe this week I'll read Andre the Giant and Transformers vs. G.I. Joe and call it good so that okay. we can actually talk about this.
Yeah, okay. Sounds good.
Cool. Well, this week my pick is Ellis Cott, Zero Number 17. This series is coming to a close in 2 issues, I believe.
Okay.
I think it's done at 18. So this month's issue and then next month's issue will be the end of the series. And I have gotten absolutely obsessed with Ellis Cott as a writer. And I'm buying all of his books because I'm an insane person. Mm-hmm. And it's mostly because I've realized that I think... And this isn't directly related to Zero, and I can say the reason why I'm excited about Zero is because I'm really just excited to see how this story is going to end, plain and simple. Like, these last 2 or 3 issues of the series have been just complete mindfucks.
Yeah.
And it ties back to that whole idea that Zero is about a mushroom trip, you know, that I was saying. So, like, or I guess I was saying before the show, but this series is just like, I took a chance on it when it came out at number one. I was like, huh, this sounds interesting, and was immediately hooked. And every single month I feel the exact same way. Like, I have that same feeling of, I want more. Things felt different enough that it doesn't feel predictable. It doesn't feel stagnating. And like, Ellis Cott is writing some of the most interesting comic books through this series, and even through his other books, Material and Bucky Barnes. I think, like, this dude is like a new wave comic book writer, and I respect the hell out of him, because the guy, he every single one of his books, at least he's said, has a message of some sort. It is tied back to something that has a much greater value than just the comic itself. And with Zero, I know he said that Zero is about how men create war, men in specifically. It's about the patriarchal society that we live in, revolving around war, and how the victims of all of these wars are always going to be women and children. And as much as the men are damaged by these things, like, it's the women and children that feel the fallout the hardest. And like, that to me, like, looking back at this whole series, puts the entire book in perspective. Like, it totally makes sense about why everything happens as it does. Like, I highly implore you to read this book. And I know, Paul, you said you've started to read it. So, but all of you listeners out there, you really, really should check this book out. Like, read the first arc. Get yourself hooked on this book. It has such a strong sense of story. Like, I don't know, there's something bigger going on, and I think 18 is going to round it out in such a way that this is going to be one of those books that is going to go down in history as, like, there should go down in history as, like, being something that is much bigger than itself. So,
yeah, absolutely. I've only read the first trade, which you should pick. It's only $10 for the first, I think, five or six issues.
Yeah, 6 issues.
Yeah, and I absolutely loved it. Yeah, it's one of those books that feels important. You know, there's a message there. Whether you are tuned into it or not, it just has that sort of prestige sort of feel. Like, it feels like an important book that's breaking new ground, sort of, in the way it's told. I mean, one thing I really like about Cott's approach is that it's not just his writing is complex or dense. He really pushes the medium, the artists he picks to work with, and they're really sort of pushing the limits of what you can do in a comic book and trying out new ideas. They don't always work for me, but I just love that, seeing people try new ideas and try new things with the format. So yeah. I need to get caught up on this, absolutely.
I mean, this book blows my mind simply because, like you said, there's a different artist every single issue. Mm-hmm. And to your point, Paul, I think that as much as he and the create other artists on the book push the medium to try to do things, it doesn't always work, but it's that the idea that he is experimenting and wants to try something and isn't trying to go for a sure thing that, like, makes you want to come back and say, what's his new experiment this month? You know, how's he going to try to change, like, tell this same story but in a different way this month? And it, like, every single month, like, no issue is the same. Like, some issues are a straightforward one-shot story. Some issues are jumping back and forth through time. Not like in, like, a Doctor Who sense, but like in a flash-forward, flashback, flash-forward, tie back 5 issues ago. Like, it's incredible, like, the way that they're working on this story together, like, all of the creators on this book. So 017 is my pick this month, and I'm super fucking pumped about it.
Oh, you don't say.
Yeah. But, you know, we're gonna take a quick second, we're gonna take a quick break, I should say, and when we come back, we've got some news stuff to talk about, and I hope you'll enjoy. We'll be back in a moment. title for this week's news gloss over, or whatever we're going to be calling it. I've got one thing to talk about. Paul's got one thing to talk about, but I'm going to start. The first thing that I wanted to announce, or I guess the thing I wanted to talk about, was the Wicked and Divine comic book is actually going to be adapted for Universal Studios, according to Deadline.com, through Matt Fraction and Kelly Sue DeConnick's Milk-Fed something-something productions. They've got their big tie-in with Universal Studios that they are using to create original shows and to adapt comics, to adapt comics of their choosing. So it looks like Wicked and Divine is going to be their first production. I know Sex Criminals was supposed to be on that docket at some point, but, you know, I remember seeing earlier this past week, Jamie McKelvey and Kieran Gillen were just freaking out, or I guess not freaking out, but reacting to everyone else freaking out about their comic book being adapted, and, like, this is really cool. I think, and going along with that, you know, I'll move into the other side of this. The series Lumberjanes from Boom Studios is actually also being adapted into a movie from 20th Century Fox. So it looks like in the next year or so, we're going to be seeing two pretty critically acclaimed books being made into another media, which is awesome, simply because it's not Marvel and DC. And on top of that, I think that what also makes this really great is that these books, I think, are going to be, or these creations are going to be heavily rooted in the source material, unlike, you know, the Avengers movie or, you know, the upcoming DC movies, which are kind of just based as independent stories and only have subtle callbacks to stories, whereas Wiccan and Divine might actually be like a direct translation to television, and Lumberjanes might actually be like a compressed version of the Lumberjanes series translated into a movie. So, Paul, I don't know, do you have any thoughts on this kind of stuff? I think this is really super cool, and I think it's a shining light on independent comics, you know, but what do you think?
I think this is exciting. I really like Wicked and Divine so far. I think it's a title that could definitely attract a pretty diverse audience that maybe wouldn't normally check out a comic book or quote-unquote comic book or superhero-based story. It seems destined, obviously, to a sort of popular adaptation. I think it's a really interesting story. Lumberjanes, I don't know much about, but it's interesting that they're going to go for a movie with that instead of a cartoon or a TV show. I think this type of stuff is good. It's exciting. And like you mentioned, it's easier to do a direct adaptation of these sort of self-contained stories rather than doing a big franchise where you have these superheroes or corporate characters that you're changing or adapting into different media. This is really just taking a comic or a good story and turning it into a different medium, which I think is good, and it will attract new readers, hopefully.
Yeah, I'm hoping. I mean, like, we've talked about this before with The Walking Dead and things where maybe they'll do some sort of advertising that says, you know, hey, if you like this series, you should also check out the comic or something like that. And I'd be really curious, and I don't think there was any intention or, I guess, discussion about this in the Lumberjanes article that I found, but I'm not sure if that's going to be an animated movie or if it's going to be a live-action movie, but either way, I think... I know that Fox has said that they are looking for a female director, and, you know, I think they're going to try to do this series good justice, because I know that this is one of those things that if Fox really fucks it up, like, they are going to lose a lot of respect, because this book is very much in on the side of, you know, I think this series is on the side of people that, like, are all about this new wave of this new movement of, like, I guess, like, women empowerment and things like that, and Lumberjanes is kind of doing that. It's it's showing, like, that women can be strong and can do all these different things, and they don't necessarily need to be pandered to, I guess. And right. Lumberjanes is kind of just like a fun all ages book about four girls lost in the woods, at least in the first issue that I read. Or maybe it's more than four girls. I might be wrong. Like I said, I have read the first issue. I haven't read anything else. But it's still, it's really exciting. I think books like this getting noticed means that Hollywood is actually looking for things that have strong fan bases to adapt. And because of that, because they have strong fan bases, they really need to do the series justice to make sure that it performs well in the box office. So both of these series, I think, are going to be really excited. I'm really, really curious to see where Wicked and Divine is going to be placed in television. Like, what network, or if any network, you know, Universal, does that mean it's going to be on NBC, or are they going to strike a deal with Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or something to get this made? So it's going to be really cool.
Yeah, that's very exciting.
And so you've got this one other piece you wanted to talk about?
A recent announcement that Marvel made was that they're going to be producing a young adult novel about Black Widow. Speaking of, you know, popular female characters who deserve a wider audience, this book, Black Widow Forever Red, is coming out in October and is written by Margaret Stoll, who wrote the Beautiful Creatures franchise, which is another young adult novel series.
This is
really interesting. Yeah, it I like this type of approach because it's a way to attract readers that maybe wouldn't be interested in checking out a comic book. And it's a good way to introduce characters that haven't normally had their own solo series or don't get as much attention on the comic book side of things, to introduce these characters to a different audience and a wider audience.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, Marvel actually did a couple other young adult novels a few years ago, had this sort of same approach. One about Rogue called, let's see if I can remember here, Rogue Touch by Christine Woodward. And another one, The She-Hulk Diaries by Marta Acosta. I actually read The She-Hulk Diaries, and I really, really liked it. It was different from the comics. It was more of it's a diary, basically, of Jennifer Walters. It's her dealing with being a successful lawyer, dealing with being a superhero, dealing with romance, trying to date at the same time. It was more engaging and entertaining than I kind of expected. I thought it would be more of like a fluff kind of novel. But it was actually a lot of fun and really enjoyable. So if they're getting these sort of higher profile artists or writers, I guess, to adapt these characters, it's a good thing to attract new readers. It would be nice that if these characters had their own solo series that people could then go pick up. But sadly, She-Hulk has been canceled. And I don't know if Black Widow still has a solo book, but...
Yeah, she does have a solo book, but it is coming to a close very quickly. Oh, nonetheless, though, it's still that's something that could be at the end of the book that says, hey, if you like this book, you could also check out this series. I mean, that just builds trade sales, which is ultimately good because, you know, if after this book is released, we see like a monstrous spike in She-Hulk sales or in Black Widow sales, maybe Marvel will reconsider and bring those series back.
And it's interesting, you know, in the wake of the Avengers movies, where Black Widow was a really popular character, but you know, we saw that they didn't make a lot of action figures for her. She doesn't really appear on a whole lot of the marketing or clothing or stuff marketed toward kids. They kind of like, she's in the movie and she's popular, but she doesn't really appear in a lot of the marketing for the movie. You know.
Yeah,
which is so frustrating. So I'm really excited that maybe instead they're going to say, no, this is a popular character, and we want people to know about her, and we're going to give an opportunity to get a bigger audience. So
yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
cool. Well, you know, we're going to take another break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about Hip Hop Family Tree and some ads and some other things. So we'll be back in just a moment. In something of, I guess, a monumental announcement this past week, Hip Hop Family Tree, published by Fantagraphics, is going to be their first monthly series ever. And that may not sound interesting or strange to anybody who's listening, but for anyone who knows anything about Fantagraphics, they are known specifically only for publishing like collected editions of comic books. But in, I guess, moving forward for, I guess, later this year, Hip Hop Family Tree number 1 is going to be debuting, which is going to continue on the series Hip Hop Family Tree, which I think has 3 volumes out right now. And this is like a crazy announcement. I mean, I did a little bit of research before the show, and you know, this company's been around since 1976, and this is their first monthly ongoing series. And sadly, I haven't read any of Hip Hop Family Tree, but I've been meaning to. Like, I see it on the shelves at comic book shops, and I'm just like, that one, I will own you. But the trades are not only humongous, but they also have a little bit of a heftier price. But that doesn't mean that their quality isn't top-notch. I've flipped through the books, and they're fantastic. Paul, have you read this book at all?
I haven't read the full volumes, but for Free Comic Book Day this year, Fantagraphics put out sort of a sampler with a few, like, 10 pages from each volume, and I read that, and it was fantastic. That was the best ad for the book, because now I absolutely have to go pick them up. And like you said, it's a book that I always see, but I'm hesitant to pick up because of the price tag and just the format. There's these big sort of impressive books, but that's what Fantagraphics does. They publish these sort of prestige titles and really nice, good-looking collections, and that comes at a price, but I think this is going to be worth it. I'm very excited to finally read that at some point.
And I think Fantagraphics also publishes Lost Love and Rockets, right? Don't you read that series?
Yep. They published the collections of Love and Rockets that were originally self-published by the Hernandez brothers, and then they published the New Stories, which is the annual new stories of the characters. So every September or so, they publish a new volume of Love and Rockets, and they put out all the beautiful-looking collections of the old issues, which, again, if you haven't read Love and Rockets, take the time. I know it's a daunting task, 30 years worth of comics, but it's well worth your time.
Cool, yeah, well, and what made this really interesting to me is I did a little bit more research on Fantagraphics, and you know they've been publishing stuff since 1976, but back in 2013 mm-hmm. they did a huge Kickstarter run. Like they wanted to raise $150,000 to try to publish essentially all of 2014's comic books, and they met their goal at $222,327. And I don't think anyone raised mm-hmm. a big stink about this, maybe because they were like, they're beneath the cusp of what is considered like a major, quote unquote, major publisher. You know, given the whole thing that happened with Archie and Kickstarter, it seems like a very interesting like look at like what their market share potentially was. Since they published all of this stuff, I think that Fantagraphics has like upped its game in terms of how much they've been putting out this past year. Obviously, getting that successful funding probably helps a lot, and I think Hip Hop Family Tree was a part of that. So, I mean, seeing this series come out in a monthly issue almost makes you think, like, damn it, I'm going to have to actually buy those collections and buy the single issues when it comes out, you know?
Yeah, like, Fantagraphics, I mean, they're one of those publishers that don't probably have a lot of presence in your typical comic book shop, you know, since they don't do superheroes, they're not one of the big two, but they have a really devoted following for people that are into some more prestige art comics, you know, and like I said, they do their work. They that money is going to a good cause because everything they produce is beautiful. They also just did that collection of Daniel Klaus's 8-Ball, the complete 8-Ball, which have you read much Daniel Klaus stuff, Mike?
I can't say that I have.
Okay. Oh, he did Ghost World and
I've read Ghost World. Okay, there we go. Yeah, I've read that.
Yeah, so it's that kind of audience. It's stuff that's very outside the mainstream, quote unquote, mm-hmm. which is exciting to see them do a monthly series because that's going to give them a bigger presence in comic book shops. And it's going to be easier for new fans to find this sort of stuff. And I think that divide we've sort of seen between mainstream superhero comics and more sort of, I hate the term art comics, but that's what I'm going to use for lack of a better term right off the top of my head. I feel like that distinction is sort of slipping. You know, there's not as big of a divide. I think comics fans like good comics, whether they have Batman in them or are, you know, Love and Rockets. I mean, I like the fact that this monthly comic from Fantagraphics might finally be another bridge between those two audiences.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we are definitely getting into a, you know, I've heard other podcasts, I've read articles and heard people say, you know, we are in the quote-unquote golden age of comics. I think comic sales are on the rise, like, every mm-hmm. month. And the amount of great comic books that are coming out is problematic to only my wallet. You know, like, I want to read yep. all this stuff. Like, I want to be able to say that I own it and that I've read it because it's all really good. Like, and it's always a different perspective. It's something that we kind of talked about in the pre-show about the various paths that people have to get to comic books. And I think we'll probably touch on that more in later this episode. But like, to say that, you know, if I could say, hey man, what are you into? And someone said, well, I just listen to hip hop, and I could say, well, I got the comic book for you. Like, that just mm-hmm. furthers that idea that there is a comic book for everyone. And that's Hip Hop Family Tree has always struck me as like such a not necessarily strange, but just such an interesting niche focus or an interesting topic to focus on, simply because like the history of hip hop to me is like only what I've seen on like VH1 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And this comic book combines like the crazy superheroics of like these fake characters and like the and action and then actual people that existed in real life. So like I don't know, this book is so unique. Like I'm really excited to see it as a single issue or a month an ongoing series, simply to have little bits of this series rather than full collected editions that I have to like, I'd want to sit down and read all at once. So we're like in a very good time for this, I think. Like, I don't think this could have happened 4 years ago, but the fact that it's happening now goes to show that like people want this kind of stuff.
if you haven't seen this series, the way it looks, it's definitely a sort of homage to Marvel Comics of the 70s. The way it's presented, the way the covers are laid out, the way it's drawn.
Totally.
Ed Piskor, the artist, sort of de-ages the pages. He uses this filter to make the actual paper of the book look sort of weathered and aged, like an old comic book. Everything about it is a celebration both of hip-hop and 70s Marvel Comics. So having it as single issues almost makes more sense. You know, it'll look like the thing it's supposed to be emulating. So do you know if they're going to be, this is going to be new material starting monthly, or are they going to be reformatting the collections and publishing those as individual issues? I couldn't tell from the article I read.
I definitely think it's going to be new material, okay. But this is simply going off of a guess. I think that what I'm actually really curious about is if they're going to keep the same paper quality. Like, if you look at the collected editions, the paper quality on these books feels like old style, like, I don't want to say like abrasive, but it's got like a cardboard feel kind of to, or like a construction paper feel to it that makes it just seem older, you know? And on top of the look of the comic and on top of like the filters you were talking about, I wonder if they're going to keep with that style. Like, I know, like, if you look at a book like Fables, way back when it was originally being published, it wasn't on glossy paper. It was on the other type of paper that, you know, that you can print on for comics. I don't know what that's called.
Like newsprint, or
It's like almost like newsprint, and I'm hoping that they keep with that same style. I mean, if they go to a glossy, you know, I'm sure it's probably for like economical reasons and things like that. But it'd be really cool to see them print it out with this like this thicker, like very aged looking book or paper. So, this is really exciting, is what it comes down to. I think this is probably going to be something where I'm going like out to my comic shop to pick it out the day number one comes out, or I'm going to pre-order it well in advance to say, like, hell yeah, I'm getting on the hip-hop family tree train. The rumors are true. DC is going to be advertising in the middle of your comic book page. Can you even believe it? I actually shouldn't be making such a big stink about this since I don't read that many DC comics. But over this, or on Friday, May 29th, there was a Chris Burnham, I should say. Let me take a step back. Chris Burnham, artist on The Nameless, posted a picture that was then subsequently deleted off of Twitter, showing a half-page ad, or not a half-page ad, but a portion of a page ad in the middle of a comic book in an upcoming DC comic book. I don't really know which one it was, but he showed this ad, and everyone on Twitter freaked out. There was a whole thing. It's a Twix ad. It's featuring Nick Lachey from, you know, the infamous pop group 98 Degrees. Husband of Jessica Simpson. I don't know. Let me pull out as much trivia as I can about this. But the fact remains that we are potentially looking at this actually happening. This rumor that we made a big stink about a couple weeks ago, at least I made a big stink about a couple weeks ago, where DC is going to be putting ads in the middle of comic book pages, not as separate pages for ads, but you'll have three quarters of a page that will have your comic book, and then that bottom quarter will be an ad, something that they did way back in the day, and apparently authors are being told to plan for this in their writing. I think this is a big deal and maybe problematic and kind of an invasion and a bunch of bullshit, but Paul, I think you have a differing opinion than I do on this.
Comic books are designed to make money. This is a capitalist medium, so ads are a fact of life when it comes to reading monthly comics. I'm not surprised that they did this. Is it intrusive? I don't really think so. I guess I haven't read the issue to say, but I think people are making a bigger deal of this than it really is. In my mind, it's not any different, and actually less intrusive than having to sit through a 15-second ad before I watch something on YouTube. That feels more intrusive to me. Maybe if it wasn't, I think the presence of Nick Lachey made it more offensive to some people. Like, of all the people, if it had been anything else, you know, any other celebrity.
Yeah.
But Nick Lachey hawking Twix is probably not the best first ad to run this way.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like you said, this is something that comic books used to do. You know, mm-hmm. if you look at old comics, it's not uncommon for there to be ads on the pages, or even ads that were designed to look like part of the comic. You know, like those classic old Hostess fruit pie advertisements. Do you remember those?
Oh, I
where, like. Yeah. Spider-Man would have to distract the Green Goblin by giving him a shitty apple fruit pie. Uh-huh. At least it's not that.
Yeah, this is true.
And if the artists are aware that their art is going to be cut up like that, they're at least making the step to say, do it in a way where we can take the ads out when we collect them into trade, and we do them and we publish the books digitally, we can remove them and reinstate the artwork.
Oh, man, I didn't even think of that. What are they going to do for that? Oh, my goodness.
Oh, they basically said the rumors I read were basically... tell the artist to be aware when they're laying out the page that they could be broken up and could also be stuck back together. So when these books are collected, there won't be blank space. They'll realign the pages so that it's one full page.
Hmm. That's yeah. Or they'll just leave the ad in. No, I'm kidding.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's something that if DC's giving you a warning, yeah, I mean, and obviously they have to with the, you know, given the medium. You know, this isn't like television where. I mean, even television is scripted for ads in a lot of cases. This isn't like something like a shitty Hulu video where they just drop an ad in sometimes and it kind of feels out of place. I think you find that happens way less often than I'm implying. But even still, like, yeah, I guess if there is some notice, then yeah, maybe it won't be so bad. But I still think this is kind of, I don't know, ads in comic books are very strange to me because, like, I understand their purpose, I understand their presence, but a lot of times they can break up a page and break up an issue in a way that, like, you lose momentum while you're reading it. Yeah. I know, like, yeah. I don't know. I think, Paul, before in the pre-show, you said that, you know, at least it's not comic book characters. At least there's not, like, Superman in the page, you know, doing something. And to that point, I think, yeah, I mean, we probably will see ads like that. Like, for a long while, you know, Allstate was running ads featuring Iron Man that looked like comic books. It wasn't Robert Downey Jr. It was an Allstate ad that looked like a comic book with pretty good art. It wasn't, like, simple line art. It was pretty well-produced art that in a couple of pages, don't get me wrong, like, as you're reading a physical comic book, like, sometimes your mind just kind of accepts that the next page is going to be the where you're going to read. And usually if there's an ad, at least for me, I know, okay, there's an ad here, I'm just going to flip the page, whatever. I don't need Spider-Man underwear in the middle of Infinity Wars. Instead, like, I was reading a comic book and I naturally went into the ad and started reading it. And to me, that's like... I don't know, like, that's an invasion of my, like, mental capacity and saying, like, oh, right. You fucking tricked me, you stupid ad. You know, it's almost like native advertising. Like, quite honestly, it is native advertising in a way. Like, you're taking this medium and you're adapting it to, you know, sell something. And I understand that's the nature of advertising and, like, really we can't have a lot without advertising, blah, blah, blah. And I don't want to necessarily get into that philosophical debate, but, like, that seems like trickery and it frustrates me.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that maybe we kind of forgot that comic books are, you know, they're something to be consumed and something that are designed to make money for the publishers.
True.
When you look at old comics, they didn't really hide that fact so much. You know, when you read comics even from the 80s, you know, 70s or 80s, there'd be that little, if there was an ad between story pages, they would put at the bottom, story continues, second page following. So you knew an ad was coming.
Yeah.
You know, they're part of the nature of the book. But as comics kind of became more highly produced, you know, catering to a different audience, they became less like periodicals and more their own sort of art form. So suddenly being reminded, like, oh, yeah, there are ads in these things and they are designed to make money.
Mm-hmm.
It feels weird, even though that's always been a part of their history. That's always been a part of it. Do you think that this might drive people to just switch to trade? To avoid these kind of ads? That seems drastic to me, but based on some of the reactions I saw on Twitter, people might either be not buying DC books anymore or switching just to trade.
I think that there's probably a little bit more outrage than actually going to have an action taken upon them. So, like, I think more people are screaming and yelling about it than they are, like, going to change their buying habits. I mean, yeah, I'm sure you'll see a handful of people moving to digital or to or to trades. But at the same time, I think you're probably going to see more people switch to digital than to trades, just simply because they don't want to be behind. You know, like, how many people pride themselves on getting a comic on Wednesday and having it done that day? You know, I mean, that's not necessarily me or you, because I know I'm the type of person that I'll go and buy 7 comic books at the shop and five digital and only read 3 that day and say, well, I guess I'm not reading Spider-Man today. You know, like, that's okay. Like, I have given into that. But, you know, look, if I look at my reading habits, you know, 6 years ago, like, I would say I went to the shop, I bought 12 books, and then I read them all that day. Getting around it. So, but I think there's more of those people out there that read the books the day they come out, or at least read a handful of key books that they know they need to read the spoilers for, because otherwise it'll be spoiled elsewhere. And those are the people that I think we're going to see not only put up the biggest amount of fuss, but also probably do some switching. But I think that percentage is small, is what I'm getting to. I think that percentage of people that are actually going to switch to trade or digital is much smaller than the actual number of people that are screaming and yelling about this. Plus, it's probably not going to be as invasive.
Yeah, exactly. There's a large part of being a comic book fan is being like stubborn in your habits.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're like set in your ways. You know, you're a DC guy or you're a Marvel guy. You read these characters, whether the books are good or not. You go to the shop every Wednesday. It's a force of habit. So, yeah, I guess you're right. I don't see a lot of people actually revenge dropping DC books as a result.
Yeah. Yeah, too many people have heavy roots in these books. And the fact remains, at the end of the day, you can always just, if you hear someone complain about this, you can just say, well, just stop reading those and read any other publisher. Like, read
right,
Image,
you know?
Read Valiant,
yeah.
Read Boom, read all these publishers that aren't going to be doing these things. Or in the case of Image, some of these books don't even have ads in them, period. So, you know, you can get around that.
And if they do, they're all in the back of the book, yeah.
Yeah, always. Which is... That's a whole different thing about, you know, ads and comic books. Like, I, you know, so we say that, you know, this is kind of a tangent conversation, but it's definitely related. You know, for books that don't have ads in them, I have to wonder how the, like, revenue streams continue. You know, like, Marvel and DC need these ads because they have a much bigger production going in, whereas Image and Valiant, they don't have ads in their books. Like, how do they, other than internal ads, you know, like, Image doesn't have ads for, you know, Robert, well, I guess without Robert Kirkman books aside, I think Image doesn't really have ads for books that are outside of Image, except for in the very rare cases of like Kurt Busiek having ads for Astro City, which is coming out from Vertigo, you know, like, but it's always comic books advertising comic books, and it's always at the end of the book. Even with Kirkman books, it's always at the end of the book. And I wonder if that like internal advertising works in their favor, or if there is just not enough. If they don't have the need for that extra revenue stream, you know? I guess, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I have to imagine that even though Image is the third largest publisher, their costs, their production costs have to be much, much lower than DC or Marvel.
What do you say that?
Well, are they publishing? I don't think they're publishing as many issues, first off. They don't have as large a slate.
This is true.
And they're probably not publishing as large print runs.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's a huge heavy factor into it.
Yeah, I mean, we see instances, you see more instances of Image books selling out the first printing. That's not because, it's because the books are popular, but a bigger reason for that is that they didn't print enough in the first place.
Right.
I actually think it would behoove Image to actually print more copies of their books to avoid those sellouts, even though it's good advertisement. Say, hey, look, this new series sold out. You better get on board.
Right.
It makes more sense. I'm not a businessman, obviously, yeah. But it seems to me to make more sense. Why don't you just print more copies then, if you think it's going to be successful?
Well, I've actually heard little bits and pieces from the few comic book shops podcasts I listen to and the people that I've actually talked to, where I may have mentioned this before on the show, but I know that Image, in some cases, with some books that they think are going to be very popular, if you as the local comic book shop order, say, 25 copies of a book, they'll send you 40 copies of the book, and with no extra cost, with the idea that if you don't sell them, you can send them back, which kind of follows the standard book and magazine policy that exists in those printing like worlds.
Yeah.
They definitely have no problem. I know in the book industry, like, they definitely have no problem like with you sending books back, and they'll just refund you your purchase. which is interesting. I had this is major tangent. I'm just going to jump off the rails here. a friend of mine and I were reading. We're both reading the same book right now. Isaac Asimov's Foundation. And inside the inside cover of the book, or inside of the book, in like 4 or 5 pages in, says, "Hey, if you bought this book without a cover, that means you bought a fraudulent sale, or that was a fraudulent sale." And that's because if you get a book without a cover like that, 9 times out of 10, or probably 99 times out of 100, it's actually because the publisher meant to send that book back, but the book was just never sent back. Because what they do is they rip off the cover, send that to the publisher, and the publisher refunds them the covers. Now, or refunds them for the number of covers that they sent. Now, I don't think in comic books it works that way, because comic books are so thin and small that sending them back is like ripping the covers off is like a negligible amount of weight, you know, compared to the actual comic book itself. So, that being said, like, yeah, I think if as far as advertising goes, to try to tie it back to everything, advertising, it must be smaller print runs. I guess I didn't consider that, given that, like, I know Warren Ellis has specifically said that, like, for Trees number one, they purposely ask for an overprint of 51,000 books, which is, like, I think a shitload of comic books for them, for Image. Yeah. I think that's way above what they expect, when most of their books are only selling between like 12 and 22,000 copies an issue, especially new number ones and popular number ones. Yeah, I guess, I mean, it probably just comes down to print runs. You're probably right, Paul. Okay, I'll be quiet.
No, well, and then finally tying it back to the actual ads themselves, it's interesting to see how DC and Marvel handle them. I feel like DC traditionally has just basically had full-page ads that don't seem too intrusive and are always for either TV shows that are related to the characters or things like that. Marvel ads are always for crappy Marvel products. Like, how many ads do you see for, like, Spider-Man backpacks in every Marvel book? I mean, it's funny to me, just the type of ads and what they're marketing towards. So maybe we're going to see a spike in Twix sales, thanks to these DC ads.
Or maybe Nick Lachey is actually going to be Green Lantern. That's what's going to happen.
Oh my, that's real hinting subtle, that. Yeah, you know? It's going to be Easter egg. Yeah. It was going to be Booster. If he's advertising things in comics, he's going to be Booster Gold, right? That's how Booster Gold's whole gimmick is, that he, you know, is a walking advertisement.
Hey, you know, it could be, you know, if we get it right, you know, we can call back to this episode.
We cracked the code, Mike. If you noticed this, Mike, but last week Thursday, Gail Simone, the writer, got a hashtag trending on Twitter, hashtag name three artists, and her original tweet was, "I'm going to ask everyone which three artists can get them to buy a comic just because they drew it," and then she used the hashtag, and obviously a bunch of fans and other creators jumped on board and started naming their artists, as did I, and I'll give you my picks, the three I picked for artists I would buy their books, sight unseen, just because they drew it. Tom Scioli, obviously, artist on Transformers vs. G.I. Joe, who does amazing Jack Kirby-influenced art. Fraser Irving, who does very painterly type stuff. He worked with Grant Morrison on a couple titles. And Becky Cloonan, who got me to buy a Conan the Barbarian book that I had no interest in the character, but the fact she was drawing it got me on board. I really like this topic because it's not just name your three favorite artists, it's think about the comic book making process and think about the importance of artists. Which artist's work sort of stands on its own separate from the writer? And I think, especially for mainstream comic books, superhero books, there's a real high focus on the writer as the creative force. That goes all the way back, you know, throughout the history of the medium. But focusing on artists and not just saying artists you like, because there's plenty of other artists that I really enjoy, but they're not enough to make me just buy the book because of their art, just to see what they're doing on the page. So I like this topic a lot, and it was really fun to see other people's names that they picked. And honestly, it's kind of tough just to pick three. So did you happen to see this, or do you have three you could think of, Mike?
I guess I didn't actually see the tweet. Unfortunately, I wish that I would have, because then I would have had like more time to prepare for this. But yeah, as I try to come up with three, you know, I kind of struggle simply because, like, obviously there's a ton of people out there that are just absolutely amazing. artists, like, it's really hard to narrow it down to even just three. You know, I could maybe give you a list of 30. But if it was like, if I had to base my entire pick off of just the artist, and I had to say, you know, is this artist, would I blindly buy a comic that this artist was a part of? I would definitely say that I think, I have to think pretty hard about this, but I know that I have two picks that I could definitely say. Uh-huh. Marco Rudy, who I mentioned earlier, is on the Winter Soldier series with Alice Cott. Marco Rudy on a book will immediately give me, if anything, I'll just buy the book blindly. But at the on the second, I mean, obviously I didn't do so with the Winter Soldier, but that's just because I was very upset about Original Sin. But nonetheless, I did end up purchasing it, and I think from now on, given the exceptional art that he's done on Bucky, or Winter Soldier, and some of the work he did on Uncanny X-Men and New Avengers, like, his art is in Marvel Knights, Spider-Man. Like, this guy, pretty much from now on, I think I will just blindly buy at least the number one for a book that he's on. He's absolutely fantastic. Like, I've already gushed about him earlier, so I don't think I need to anymore. Jason Howard, I think, is another artist that I will always try his number one, simply because he is one of those writer or one of those artists that, like, I think he picks his books very selectively. Which isn't to say that I think that he, I don't know. I don't think he's, let me try to rephrase that. I think Jason Howard, he doesn't get picked very often to do books, but when he does them, he adapts. Like, I've been following this guy since he was on Astounding Wolfman, Robert Kirkman, and to see where he is from then until now with Warren Ellis on Trees, like, he has grown as an artist, like, exponentially. And like, so, and I've always bought, like, I've bought every single book that he's been on, every book that he's done. I have followed him since Astounding Wolfman, simply because I've loved his art. And the guy does some of the best comic book looking art you can find. And that's like a strange thing to say about a comic book artist, because, you know, we prize realism, we really like line art, we really like all this different stuff, but like, straight, regular, what you'd expect out of a comic book art, this guy does it like 1,000 times over, and he does it so well that, like, he has, like, perfected that craft, which I think a lot of artists still struggle with. Like, you find artists that are, like, you know, Ben Temple Smith, that are, like, very specifically niche, you know, like, they only can do one type of comic book, whereas I think Jason Howard can do a vast range, and the guy has it down to a, like, a T. He's very, very good at what he does. Especially, I mean, like, honestly, look at an issue of Trees, and then look at an issue of Super Dinosaur, or which is a kid's book, or look at Astounding Wolfman. Like, it's night and day, the differences. But that he's got this very large range that all fall within his look, but they definitely have different feels. So, and as for a third... Oh, I'm struggling. I don't know. That's really hard. Now I'm trying to think of all the big creators that I really, really respect. And I think I think Lenil Yu is one of those creators that I don't see very often, but when he does something, like, it's always a very cool take on his stuff. Oh, but then I'm like, oh, what about Sean Phillips? You know? Or, you know,
that's a good one.
Sean Phillips, and I've said this before, and actually, you know what? I will say Lenil Yu, I like him a lot, but Sean Phillips is probably my guy for the last one. Simply because I always know what to expect with Sean Phillips in a way that, like, his style is very, 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 very much like Jason Howard's, in that, like, it's very, like, I know what I'm going to get out of his book, but every time his take on that same look is very unique. Like, it's the same look, but it has a different feel every single time. Like, you look at Fatale versus Incognito versus what's the series that he's on right now? The Fade Out, you know? Like, Fade Out. Those, like, those books, they all have dudes that all look the same. But the feels of those books, and I think a lot of that has to do with the colorists, but the feel and, like, just, like, the overall, like, general look of the book is always different, even though the characters kind of have similar, like, looks and feels and stuff. So I think, yeah, Sean Phillips is on a book. I mean, him and Ed Brubaker will work together forever, so I'm guaranteed a good book forever. But if he was on anything else, I would definitely try it, I think.
Yeah, yeah. It's always funny to find people like that who have an established style find early issues when they're just getting started. I remember when I was reading Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol for the first time, mm-hmm. there's one issue that Sean Phillips does, and it's so different from his work now, because obviously he's just getting started, and this was probably, you know, early 90s.
Yeah.
So the way he did his art was completely different, and I would never would have guessed it was him. But it was just kind of cool to see his name on this book, mm-hmm. you know, back then.
Yeah, and that's actually the exact same thing I was going to say about Len Liu. Like, I read Global mm-hmm. Frequency a couple months back, and I think Len Liu definitely did an issue of that. And I would never have known it was him, given his style then versus what he does now. Like, the guy has grown, like, phenomenally since then. Like, he's not like a Jim Lee who I think has, like, been doing the same art for, 20 years, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and then that's such an amazing thing to see, like, an artist grow that much in such a short amount of time. Because Global Frequency only came out, I mean, I think 2003 or 4 or something like that. So, like, it's only, I mean, I guess it's been, you know, 10, 12 years. But even still, like, it's insane to not even be able to tell side by side that these were the same creator, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that there's a difference between artists that whose work you really like, just visually, and artists whose work isn't interesting to you if they're doing the book? Does that make sense? Is there a difference between artists who just do good-looking work and artists that are able to bring a level of craft to a book that makes it more appealing?
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying. Like, I think of like Alex Ross. Right?
Sure.
Like, yeah, Alex Ross is, I think, one of the best examples of that. Like, Alex Ross, as an artist, does some of the most beautiful art in the comics medium today. Hands down, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't think that his art necessarily enhances a story. I think, a lot of people I know have a problem with him because they're like, well, if I just wanted a painting, I'd look at a painting. It's like, but that's not, I mean, sure. That's not the point. But his art is very beautiful, but I don't think it necessarily enriches a story. Whereas, like, when you look at someone like, and I'm only going to go back to Temple Smith because I think he's the most obvious choice here. You look at someone like Ben Temple Smith, if you would have picked any other artist to work on Fell with Warren Ellis, for instance, I think it would have mm-hmm. been a completely different book.
Sure.
I don't think anyone else could have captured the feel and the, like, grim and darkness of that book like Temple Smith did. So I think, like, I don't know if that necessarily answers your question. I kind of just gave two examples of that. But,
no, I mean, Alex Ross is the perfect example because, yeah, his art, when you see his work on a cover or, like, on a poster or something, it's gorgeous. When you actually read a book that he painted, or, you know, it everything's very static. It doesn't feel like a comic book. It just feels like a series of still images.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, there's no motion, which is such a strange thing that we put implied emotion into a comic book, but like we almost have to. And unfortunately, with someone like Alex Ross, like there isn't. Yeah, there really is. It's not stagnant, but it is very still. Like, I'm not actually seeing Superman flying through the air. I'm seeing Superman in the air. In a picture, you know,
right? Yeah,
and that's such an interesting take on that. But yeah, so did you see any other I guess interesting picks for this hashtag that you followed?
Well, do you know Ramon Villalobos, the artist? I know he's done some X-Men stuff recently.
Oh, I'm sure I know him. Like, I just don't know him by name.
Okay, yeah, he's fantastic. His tweet for Name Three Artists was easy. It says Ramon Villalobos, Ramon Villalobos. And Ramon Villalobos because I spit hot fire. And I have to agree. That's a guy who I think, if you're not familiar with his work, just grab a book he's done. He does a fantastic, fantastic stuff. Let's see.
Oh, yeah, I'm going through the hashtag right now. I'm seeing Jock is a big one. I forget about Jock. I mean, he's not my favorite, but I understand. Ooh, yeah. Mike Allred. Shit.
There you go.
Mike Allred. That's another guy. Oh, my gosh. I'll pretty much buy anything with his name on it.
That's interesting because when I was sort of picking my three, I was kind of stuck because a lot of artists I like, but they are artists that are also writers. They are the creator of the book. And I wasn't sure if that's really the purpose of, you know, this sort of social experiment. Mm-hmm. You know, like I picked Tom Scioli, and obviously he does mostly creator-owned work. He's writing the books and he's writing them and drawing them. But his work is so interesting that I wanted to basically just give him a shout out. But someone like Jaime Hernandez, I think, is in my top three, probably top two comic book artists of all time. It's Jack Kirby and Jaime Hernandez. Mm-hmm. But because he does Love and Rockets and is also the writer, it's obvious that I'm going to be attracted to his books. So that distinction, playing with that distinction between the artist and the writer, I think is what's really interesting about this, because it really makes you focus on what is the artist doing, what is the artist bringing to the book?
Yeah.
They're not just adapting what the writer tells them to draw or suggests to draw. They're really a part of the creative process.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's.
But so anyway, Mike Allred is a guy who I mostly know from his creator-owned work, the Madman stuff. So that's why I wanted to bring
it up. See, I come at it from a different perspective only because I was, you know, I followed him on Ecstatics. And I follow, or I should say, I read Ecstatics. I didn't actually read it when it was coming out, unfortunately. But I read Ecstatics, and I've been reading Silver Surfer. And like, but to that extent, I think Mike Allred as a creator, like, despite him being just quote unquote the artist on the book, I think he has a very like, he is the type of creator that has a very heavy influence on the story of a book too. Like in the most recent issue of Silver Surfer, which I implore everybody in the world to read, by the way, like just issue number 10, fuck the rest of it, just read number 10. It's one of the coolest concepts and takes on, like, it's one of those books that you kind of like, they're gonna win an Eisner Award on like best single issue simply because of the way that the story is told. Like, oh, it was so beautiful. It takes the idea of a Moebius strip and just takes it to the next level, but inside of a fucking 2D comic book. Oh my gosh.
Okay.
Check it out if you get a chance. But I think Mike Allred, in this most recent issue, the reason why I bring it up is because Mike Allred is, he is credited as a creator and not as the artist. So it's Dan Slott, Mike Allred as creators. And I think that's because he's the type of artist that gets very, very involved in the creation of the comic, even in the writing of the comic, so that he like can say, yes, I can draw that. No, I can't draw that. Not because of his own limitations, but because he wants to try to, because Mike Allred is one of those artists that really, really, really wants to take comics to the next level by trying new things all the time. At least from my understanding, like especially all I know from what I've read of Madman and what I've seen in Silver Surfer, like the guy is out there. Like he really wants to try new things with comic books all the time. And Silver Surfer number 10 is a perfect example of that. So go drop $4. If you don't like it, I will pay you back for that $4. Like, it's so good.
You heard it here, folks.
But yeah, there is the fine line, though. I think being a writer and artist is a little bit different than just being an artist, because one person versus two people, it comes down to something as simple as that.
Right. Yeah, so I was kind of interested to see how people approach that, because naming your favorite artist is easy, but thinking about the creative process and saying, these are the artists that are doing something unique that is interesting and will enhance the book and make it more appealing. A good example is Frank Quitely, who is a genius, but I'm not reading that Jupiter's Legacy thing or whatever that he's doing with Mark Millar, because I don't like Mark Millar. You know, there's nothing in that book that is appealing to me given the other creator, even though I love the art so much. So when it comes to naming an artist whose work it would make you buy a book, even if it's written by someone you can't stand, that's the highest compliment you can really give a comic book artist.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. I totally agree with that.
Oh, David Aja. Aja, however you say it. That's another one that I see popping up a lot, and that's a very good pick, yes. Because, honestly, he's the reason I picked up Hawkeye in the first place.
Yeah, I'm going through this list. There are so many good artists out there. Like, it makes trying to name just three break my heart, because there's so many people.
It's incredibly hard.
Alex Maleev, Darwin Cook, like...
Oh, Fiona Staples. You guys. Okay, that's how did I forget Fiona Staples? Yeah,
Fiona Staples doesn't count because she's only on one goddamn book.
Well,
two coming up. Two coming up. I know she's doing Archie, which is really exciting too. But
that's very exciting. Is that going to get you to buy Archie?
This is a really cool thing. I think this is a really interesting take, or really interesting way to like get information from people. Because I guarantee you, a lot of these people sat and thought about this, or a lot of them had instant answers. And it's very, very cool to see. This is one thing I love about Twitter, in specific. Like, I think Facebook, Tumblr, Instagram, Pinterest, I don't think any of them have this type of social collaboration like Twitter does, and I'm so thankful that Gil Simone is actively active on this. Like, there is so much hate and so much anger and so much awfulness that happens on Twitter, and you see like people like Matt Fraction or Joss Whedon leaving Twitter because of it, and yet you see like someone like Gail Simone is standing up and like giving, in a way, giving a big middle finger to all of those people, saying like, you're not gonna bother me, I'm gonna do this thing and keep a very, very, very positive light on it. Like, I have to credit her and for being so influential and also so positive about everything, because I'm certain, and this is awful that we are in this world, that this is a certainty for me, that she gets all sorts of threats and all sorts of bad everything towards her, and yet I think she brushes it off and keeps moving forward. And it's so amazing that like she creates this safe space on the internet for people.
Yeah, especially exactly. On Twitter. Thank you for saying that, because that's obviously something, a real dark side of social media, and specifically like really devoted fan bases that can be really what's the word I'm looking for, insular, and threatening. I mean, we've been seeing so many examples of outspoken people being attacked on Twitter. It can be really depressing when looking at comic book Twitter. Mm-hmm. So to see something positive like that's just celebrating the medium, there's no judgment, it's just saying, hey, what do you like about comics?
Right.
I remember a few months ago, there was a similar thing where somebody asked, you know, what were the four comics that made you a comic fan? Basically, not just your first comic, but the comics you kept going to and established your fandom. And it was really remarkable just to follow that hashtag. There was no explanations, no labels. It was just images, just covers of old comics, or new and old, from all across different countries, different creators, different genres, celebrating the fandom of being comic book fans. That's, we have to do more of that and be accepting of that and celebrate it, you know, not the sort of negativity that we normally see on the internet.
Yeah, and it's so amazing. I kind of touched on it earlier, you know, about the idea of, you know, everyone getting, you know, having different paths that bring them to comic books. And I think in the pre-show, Paul and I talked about how, you know, despite our varying past in comic books and what got us started and what got us to where we are now, we somehow managed to find ourselves looking at the same books and having a great appreciation for them, but coming from like severely different backgrounds, which is incredible.
Yeah.
And you know, like, we're both reading, you know, Zero, for instance, or we're both reading Material, I think was the one that we were both talking about. It's like, how do we get there? Like, what drew us to that comic? And it's completely different reasons, and yet we can both find a way to appreciate that comic book. And so something like this hashtag, what four comics brought you to comic books, is just like an amazing example of that. Seeing all this varying paths, and yet you could probably find 100 of those Twitter followers or those Twitter users reading the same book, and they have like varying reasons as to why that book is great for them. I mean, comic books going back to the hip hop family tree thing, it's comic books are for everyone, and there is a comic book for everyone, which is the beautiful thing about it. So real happy. I mean, like, I'm real excited and happy to see that like something like these things exist, and it's started by people who have a lot of sway in the industry, and or not necessarily in the industry, but on the internet, because of how fantastic they are as creators in general.
Yeah, exactly. And the connection we're seeing between the creative community and the fan community, that there's not a gap anymore. You know, it's all the same because of things like Twitter and conventions and stuff. So to have that camaraderie between both fans and creators it's exciting, you know? Because I feel like the first time that's really has been no disconnect between the two in the history of the medium.
Thank you for listening to the I Read Comic Books podcast, a production of Destroy the Cyborg, produced by Mike Rappin, and produced and edited by Xander Riggs. This week's music was brought to you by Brock Berrigan, Danger Doom, Danger Mouse, Gemini, and Infinity Shred. If you'd like to keep up with the I Read Comic Books podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And while you're there, take a quick moment to rate us. If you have any questions, or would like us to talk about something on the podcast, you can email the show at cyborg@destroythecyb.org. You can also follow us on Twitter @destroythecyb and on Tumblr @destroythecyborg.tumblr.com. And, as always, thank you for listening.
Nick had that. Nick posted some topics, which he's in Chicago this weekend. Otherwise, he would have been here visiting some friends.
Yeah.
But yeah, he posted the grumpy cat thing, which
I don't have anything to say about that. I guess
I'm gonna just skip over that because I don't even like fucking. I don't license properties like that. I don't understand, for one, how they are licensed properties. Like, it's just a fucking internet meme that, like, blew up.
Yeah.
Although I did, you know, I will say I was in, where was I? I was walking through the Strand. Have you ever, I think it's the Strand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Me and my buddy were walking through there because I was picking up, I'm reading the Foundation series. I just finished the first one, so I went to go buy the second one. And there was this kid and his mom, and this kid was so fucking excited that they had grumpy cat, like, little stuffed animals. Sure. Like, he was like, "Mom, can you believe it? It's so soft. Look at it." It's like, maybe that's, they're trying to appeal to, like, younger kids. This kid couldn't have been any older than, like, 8 or 9. Like, he was so into it. But I don't know. That thing, I don't understand it, and maybe I'm not meant to, you know?
Yeah, I don't. Grumpy Cat, for some reason, hosted Monday Night Raw a few months ago, and I didn't get
it. Wait, the actual cat was there?
Yeah, they had the actual cat there, and like the wrestlers would like go like interact with it. It was the dumbest thing I've ever seen.
Oh my gosh! Sorry, that's just absurd.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Okay, I don't want to talk about Grumpy Cat then. No, I mean...